CSRD. Ännu en förkortning som väcker känslor hos företagare. Men lugn, våra rådgivare här på PWC har koll på det som din verksamhet berörs av. Från hållbarhetslösningar och nya regelverk till affärsutveckling och ansvarsfulla AI-strategier. Välkommen till PWC.
Välkommen till Unionen.
Jo, jag undrar hur många semesterdagar jag har som projektanställd. Och vad gör jag om jag inte får något semestertillägg? Påverkar det inkomstförsäkringen? För jag har blivit varslad, till skillnad från min kollega som ofta kör härskarteknik på möten och dessutom har högre lön trots samma tjänst. Vad gör jag nu?
Okej, vi tar det från början.
Jobbigt på jobbet. Som medlem i Unionen kan du alltid prata med våra rådgivare.
Välkommen till Telenor röstbrevlåda.
Hej lilla gumman. Det är pappa. Mamma sa att du hade ringt. Ring mig igen. Jag är hemma nu. Puss, puss.
För att repetera detta meddelande, tryck.
Spara samtalet när du förlorat den som ringde på telenor.se/missedcalls.
Welcome to Britain's Hidden Divide. Anywheres versus somewheres.
Both of these worldviews are perfectly decent. The problem for our politics is that one of them has been completely dominant.
Were people very angry with you?
Well, some people, yeah. I mean, I was called a nice racist, and liberal people do racism too. Lots of Labour MPs would come up to me and sort of say, you know, I can't say this in public, but I absolutely agree with the issues that you're raising.
David Goodhart är en brittisk författare och journalist som ville att Storbritannien skulle stanna kvar i EU, men ändå förstår de känslor som ledde till Brexit. Han är kritisk till samhällets strävan att allt fler ska ha en hög akademisk utbildning, samtidigt som de som arbetar i traditionella yrken och i vården har fått se sin status försämrats, trots att det är de som arbetsmarknaden skriker efter. Nu är David Goodhart på besök i Sverige. Har regeringar i västvärlden tappat sin känslighet för folkliga stämningar? Och varför vill så många utbilda sig till yrken där det är stort överskott på arbetskraft? Jag heter Cecilia Garme.
We anyways have ruled in our own interests and called it the national interest. On June the 23rd, the somewheres said enough. Welcome to Britain's hidden divide. Anywheres versus somewheres.
David Goodhart, welcome to Fredagsintervjun.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Very glad to be here.
I'd like to start with what you were talking about in that BBC clip from 2017 that we just listened to. Was it the conflict between somewheres and anywheres that was the reason for Brexit?
In one word, yes. I think it was a very big factor. The education-based value divides that have become, particularly since the expansion of higher education in Britain, as indeed in many other rich Western countries over the last 30, 40 years, has been a very big factor, I think, in creating this this divide between what I call the anywheres, meaning, or the people that see the world from anywhere, meaning the highly educated people, people who have at least a university degree, and who often, and this is particularly true in Britain, although I think it's also true to some extent in other European countries, tend to leave their hometowns, their original circle of family and friends, and move not just physically to another place, but sort of sociologically. They join a whole new network of people, all of whom are also, by definition, at university. And there tends to be a dominant set of values among that group which stress mobility, because the people have generally been mobile themselves. They tend to have relatively weak attachments to place and to group. They tend to place a high value on openness, autonomy. They tend to be anti-authority, to some extent anti-tradition. I mean, they're kind of liberal, and, you know, not always in a bad way, but they have a very a very dominant worldview, and they have come in most of our societies now, the people I call the anywheres, the people that see the world from anywhere, are probably about 20, 25, even 30% of the population. Whereas on the other hand, you have the people who see the world from somewhere, the somewheres who are much less well-educated normally, they haven't been to university, they give greater priority to security, to familiarity, and they tend to have what is called an ascribed identity, whereas there's this identity spectrum. This idea actually comes from the American sociologist Talcott Parsons, who talked about an identity spectrum with an achieved identity at one end and ascribed at the other. Anywheres tend to have achieved identities, meaning that their sense of themselves comes from their own achievements. They passed it. They did well at school, they passed exams, they've gone into professional life. And that if you have an achieved identity, your identity is quite sort of protected in a way. You can carry it around with you. Whereas if you have an ascribed identity, you are, say, in the British case, say you might be a kind of northern working class British white man. Things about you that you can't change are the dominant aspect of your identity. Now, if you have a mainly ascribed, we all have a mixture of both achieved and ascribed. If you have a mainly ascribed identity, you tend to have a stronger connection to place and to group. And that means that if place and group change for whatever reason, because of high immigration, gentrification, whatever, that you're more likely to feel discomforted by change than if you have an anywhere achieved identity. It sounds, as I say, very simplistic and binary. It's actually not. I mean, there are lots of different kinds of anywheres. There are lots of different kinds of somewheres. There's also a big in-betweener group, about 25% of the population.
Yeah.
So the anywheres are, I estimate, around 25%. The in-betweeners, who share the two worldviews almost equally, are about 25%.
Yeah.
Somewheres tend to be about 50%.
Do you think that the proportions would be the same in Sweden as in Britain? About half of the population being somewhere somehow?
I would say, yeah, from I don't know Sweden well, but from what I do know of, you now have about, the same as in Britain, you now have about 50% of school leavers who go to university, probably about a third of the working population are graduates, something like that.
So does this reflect differences in psychic structures, or is it social? What is the basis for these concepts?
It's values and attitudes, and values and attitudes that arise from social experience. So it's often sociological. You know, anywheres tend to be more middle class and upper class, but there are people who rise into the kind of graduate cognitive class is another way of thinking about it. There are people from working class backgrounds who rise into it. It's a combination, I guess, of sort of attitudinal and sociological. But I do think there is quite a lot of evidence to say that people, although I sort of contest the idea that this mass cognitive class is on average more clever or capable than the average person who doesn't go to university. I mean, clearly there are some very clever people, who rightly go to elite universities and who are going to I hope come up with technical solutions to climate change and the kind of people that invented the vaccines, and we need very clever people. Most people who go through university and into the professional sort of cognitive class are not more capable than other people, but nonetheless there is an assumption that clever people who dominate that group. There is an assumption, I think, amongst the highly intelligent that the movement, the free movement of ideas, which can very quickly lead to the kind of free movement of people, is a sort of unqualified good. There's a sort of bias towards, I think psychologists understand this, there's a sort of bias towards openness.
Yes.
And indeed perhaps a bias to the political left amongst both the cleverer and the more highly educated, and the two groups obviously overlap, but they're not the same.
Yeah. What is fascinating, I think, is that the UK and Sweden are two very different countries. Britain being the paramount example of a class society, the way we see it from our horizon, where Sweden at least used to be a more egalitarian society. But we do have the same divide, it seems, between anywheres and somewheres. So what does that say about the economic explanation that is sometimes put forward by the left, that this is actually not about culture, it is about economy?
Well, I mean, it's surely you have a myth, quite a powerful myth of classlessness. I mean, your secondary schooling divides, doesn't it?
Yes.
Into the kind of manual technical and the academic. I mean, and overwhelmingly, the children who go into the academic stream are the children of the middle and the upper middle classes. And overwhelmingly, the children that go into the technical stream are from working class backgrounds.
Yeah, and they are few.
Yeah. I mean, I'm staying in Uppsala, which rather reminds me of Oxford or Cambridge. I mean, even I came out the other day and there were... And suddenly all these students, you know, wearing ball gowns and evening dress, you know.
Uppsala is quite particular.
It is, yeah. It doesn't represent all of Sweden. But, I mean, so I think I would... class and economics, socioeconomic factors do still play quite an important role in our politics. But surely the whole point about the rise of populism... Even in very egalitarian places like the Nordic countries, like Sweden, shows that it isn't just about economics. These cultural psychological things that I'm talking about are hugely important. And there's been a kind of lack of emotional intelligence on the part of, I mean, so you know, just to go back to the anywhere somewhere divide. As I said earlier, both of these worldviews are perfectly decent. The problem for our politics is that one of them has been completely dominant. And that creates political instability. You know, the idea of the sort of balanced constitution, the mixed constitution, that all the big sort of interest groups in society should have their say and their voices should be heard, has been abandoned to some extent. And you therefore get these disruptions like Brexit, because people felt that, you know, people with more somewhere worldviews felt that their worldviews were not reflected in politics, whichever party was in power, whether it was Labour or the Tories. And similarly in America, and so you get this sort of sudden eruption. If you don't, and in some ways, continental Europe has played this politics better because proportional representation. So we used to think in Britain that because we had first past the post, we were immune to populism because the populist parties never got, UKIP, you know, has never had a single member of parliament except for Tories who moved to it. Nigel Farage was never elected anywhere. So we thought that first past the post meant that we were immune. But actually, we weren't. I mean, it made the system more brittle, and it kind of broke with Brexit. Whereas in continental Europe, because of proportional representation, you've absorbed populism. I mean, I think 7 or 8 European countries have had populist parties in government, even running the countries briefly.
Yeah.
And that has helped to domesticate populism to some extent. If you're in government, you learn all the compromises necessary. You have to drop all this rhetoric about elites being monstrous or whatever, because you're part of it yourself. you haven't yet had the Sweden Democrats in government in Sweden, though I suspect you probably will have in the next few years. I think certainly elsewhere in Europe, you've been able to absorb, what is legitimate in the populist case.
Let's talk about immigration, because that's one big factor playing behind this conflict. I would have guessed that Britain has had a large immigration for many, many decades because it was an empire and that therefore you were sort of used to that. But after the Eastern European countries accessed the EU, and they started come to London, it suddenly was something else. Can you describe that? Were they different somehow from the ones that had come to Britain as subjects or former subjects of the British Empire?
No, nobody expected so many people to come. I mean, I think the expectation was that 10 or 15,000 a year would come. And in fact, about 1.5 million people came over the next sort of 3 or 4 years.
So it was very, very sudden.
It was very sudden. In certain communities, it was very big. And it was also the kind of the feeling that this was, you know, whereas people from the Commonwealth had come here, there was friction in some places. But there was a kind of feeling, you know, they had come here to make a life. You know, they were going to become, you know, black or South Asian British citizens. There were differences of culture that had to be negotiated, integration and segregation issues. But they were kind of, you know, they were here. They were part of our history. In the case of the free movement of people from Central and Eastern Europe, there was no particular prejudice against people from Central and Eastern Europe, but there was a feeling that it was that they could come and go as they liked. You know, that they had all the rights beyond voting in national elections. They were able to vote in local elections. Beyond voting in national elections, they had exactly the same rights as a British citizen. People from countries that we had no historical connection to, and they could come. They could work, they could, you know, use the welfare system, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that was, there was a feeling that there was sort of something wrong about that. You know, either you're sort of coming here to live permanently. Of course, some of them did come and live permanently or have come and lived permanently in Britain. But it was the sort of indeterminacy of it. It was the uncertainty of it.
So it sort of challenged fundamental concepts of just of...
Yeah, kind of.
What's just
fair. Of kind of, you know, fellow citizen favouritism. I mean, that, you know, we should place the interests of fellow citizens before universal or even European interests, this, which is not to say that European or universal interests don't exist. They do exist, and we should take them seriously. But but national citizen rights should surely trump that. So if you suddenly find yourself behind the housing queue for public housing, you know, behind somebody from Slovenia or whatever, you know, you may feel a certain sense of resentment, which I think to label that as racist just seems naive, really. You know, people have been brought up to believe that, you know, that being a national citizen of Sweden, of Britain, of America, wherever, you know, gives you certain citizenship rights that take priority over people from other countries.
Yeah. Let me then ask you, these people, were they working?
Yes,
they had jobs, most
of the people
came to work.
They did.
And
they also brought their families. Mm. So, and I think that was one of the other things, is that it was completely unplannable for. You couldn't plan. You know, some local authorities were overwhelmed. Certain parts of the country, and also another factor actually that's quite important here is they went everywhere. Because there were job opportunities everywhere. The British economy was booming at the time, and of course, in some ways, you might think that's quite good that they went. They weren't just going, you know, so much of the post-war Commonwealth immigration had concentrated in London, in Birmingham, in Manchester, and then one or two other places like the famous mill towns where there's been conflict in northern England. So they were very, very concentrated. With the Central and Eastern Europeans, they went absolutely everywhere. In some ways, that was beneficial. Mm. You know, they were needed in a lot of rural communities to, you know, to pick fruit or whatever. But everybody in the country was sort of affected, even if only slightly.
Yeah. How would the reactions have been had they been, like many of those who came to Sweden, they couldn't find work?
Well, I think the reaction would have been more hostile. you know, if people had come... and we're just sort of sitting at home and taking benefit. I mean, I think that is one of the things that the UK immigration has not suffered in that respect, in the way that some Northern European countries, you know, like, you know, Belgium, the Netherlands, Sweden. I think, you know, you have had a big problem with people coming often from quite traditional countries, not joining the labour market. and, you know, essentially being seen as a burden on the welfare state. We haven't had that. So that wasn't so much the story in the UK.
There is a subgroup in that you were mentioning earlier briefly, the global villagers. And as I read your book, I think about, for instance, our former foreign minister and prime minister, Carl Bildt, who is famous exactly for traveling the world a lot and attending seminars and giving talks and being a very international person. And you told a story in an interview that I listened to. You had been to a dinner and you had been seated at the side of one of the top BBC people and someone who was a top civil servant. And they both explained to you that it is global welfare that they are after in their office and not the national welfare. Describe your reaction to that.
Well, it was kind of one of the things that prompted me to write the book. I got into this debate sort of by accident. I wrote an essay in the magazine I edited, Prospect, called Too Diverse? Back in 2004, in which I talked about... It was very much directed. I saw myself then very much as part of the sort of centre-left, left-liberal tribe. And I wrote this essay kind of drawing attention, I thought, quite sensitively to people on the left, that there is actually a kind of underlying tension between the two values that we hold most dear, solidarity and diversity. I mean, if you accept the common sense assumption that people are ready to share with and trust people who with whom they have something in common, it doesn't have to be skin colour or religion, but you have to have some shared norms or experience to feel comfortable and trusting people. And it was reprinted in The Guardian, the main centre-left newspaper, and it caused a bit of a furore at the time. And I went on, partly as a result of that, I spent 10 years being invited constantly to seminars and conferences on immigration and multiculturalism and so on. So,
people very angry with you?
Well, some people, yeah. I mean, I was called a nice racist, and liberal people do racism too. It was a typical sort of comment from some quarters. Of course, lots of other people. I mean, lots of Labour MPs would come up to me and sort of say, I can't say this in public, but I absolutely agree with the issues that you're raising. But anyway, I went on to write a book called The British Dream in 2013. And
we'll talk about that book in a little while.
And it was partly because I'd become, as it were, sort of sensitized to the way that people outside the kind of anywhere cognitive class think about things, and I'd become, you might say, sympathetically sensitized to it. That when I found myself at this Oxford dinner, sitting between the guy O'Donnell, who was he was head of the civil service, and the BBC guy was head of the BBC. I mean, these were two of the most powerful, probably the two most powerful unelected positions in British society, mm-hmm. and both of them having this view that it was not their job to kind of maximise the interests of British citizens, but they had this kind of liberal universalist view. And they were proud of it. It really quite shocked me. And it definitely contributed to me writing the Road to Somewhere book.
Yeah. Just to challenge you, wouldn't they be right in saying that globalisation is everywhere? Not only global capital is flowing, but goods, human contacts, cross-border travel, tourism, communications, business relations, private relations, friendships. Isn't it true, like they were probably saying to you, that globalisation is everywhere?
Well, globalisation has been a very important, particularly economic globalisation, has been a very strong force. But, I mean, that doesn't mean that you should, abandon, as it were, common sense ideas about how national democracy works. And also, I think we exaggerate the extent of globalisation. I think it's still only about 3 or 3.5% of the world's population live in countries outside the one they were born in. Mass movement of people is a very, very small phenomenon. I mean, it happens, you get sudden surges, obviously, if there's something like the Ukraine conflict. But, these conflicts do often last longer than they used to, but they do generally come to an end and then people return home. And also, I mean, there's the very, very big question of brain drain. I mean, if you're a liberal-minded person and you're really concerned about the world becoming more balanced And it has become a lot more balanced in terms of the distribution of wealth across nations in the last 20 or 30 years, partly, as we know, because of the way that globalization has lifted up China and India, partly thanks to the American-led decision to allow China into the World Trade Organization back in the early 2000s. You know, you might say thanks to the generosity of the West, a generosity which was paid for, you know, by, you know, the working class in rich countries in many respects. Okay, they were still doing pretty well if you look at the global metric, but nonetheless, a lot of people in the American industrial belt, in the British industrial belt, in the Swedish industrial belt, lost their jobs because of that openness. And I think, you know, there is a case for saying, you know, we should have done these things more slowly. Now, it's true that national policy can mitigate the effects of it, and free trade does benefit the vast majority of people. But I do think that the pro-immigration left is always very blind to the brain drain impact. You know, if you know the kind of people that have the get up and go, and often the resources to, you know, whether they're refugees or kind of mainstream economic migrants, those people tend to come from, you know, the most energetic and ambitious and often best educated sections of poorer countries. So we are denuding those countries by having a more open approach to immigration in rich countries. Mm. It's quite understandable. If I was one of them, I would no doubt want to. You're short-circuiting the historical process, in a sense. You're saying, me and my family are not prepared to wait the 100 years that it might take for Eritrea to catch up with Western Europe.
Which makes sense, yeah, of course.
From an individual point of view, yeah. from a society point of view, it is not in Eritrea's interests to lose a big section of their political and economic elite.
Hej, Ludde Hellberg här, undersökande journalist på Kvartal. Jag gör granskningar på många olika områden, exempelvis om skolan och om migrationen. Om du har tips är du alltid välkommen att höra av dig till mig på ludde.hellberg@kvartal.se. Och om du tycker om den journalistik som vi på Kvartal gör, så är det bästa du kan göra att stödja oss på regelbunden basis som månadsgivare eller som licenstagare. Gå in på kvartal.se/gava och läs om hur du gör. Tack för att du läser och för att du lyssnar.
You are calling for what you call a decent populism. In your book you use this word, and also you talk about
CSRD. Ännu en förkortning som väcker känslor hos företagare. Men lugn, våra rådgivare här på PwC har koll på det som din verksamhet berörs av. Från hållbarhetslösningar och nya regelverk till affärsutveckling och ansvarsfulla AI-strategier. Välkommen till PwC.
Hej, Synoptik här. Visste du att solens UV-strålar kan vara skadliga och åldra dina ögon i förtid? Kom in till oss så hjälper vi dig att hitta rätt solglasögon som skyddar dina ögon. Välkommen till Synoptik.
Ja?
Hallå? Pizzeria Grandiosa? Jag vill ha en Grandiosa capriciosa och en pepperoni.
Haha, något mer?
En kaffefilter.
Ja, okej, ses samma.
Grandiosa, hela Sveriges hempizza. Den med mycket på.
When you are describing the somewheres, I as I read it, the anywheres have unfounded prejudice about them. Can you describe their values on other things, sort of personal freedoms, gay rights, that kind of things? Often, yeah, in the debate, the somewheres are, you know, given names as being very authoritarian and very traditional and very, very backwards.
Yeah, I think that is not true, generally speaking. I think what is true is that, you know, educated people tend to be more ideological. They probably also tend to be a bit more extreme at both ends of the political spectrum. They tend to be more ideological in the sense, if you're an educated person, you almost feel a duty to have a kind of worked-out political worldview, even if many of the political packages we have are actually internally inconsistent, in the sense that, you know, conservatives are meant to believe in, conserving things and continuity, and yet they also believe in free market capitalism, which is the most disruptive force the world has ever seen. You know, left-wing people believe in raising the wages of the poor, and yet they also believe in relatively open immigration, which suppresses the wages of the poor. I mean,
yes.
So the packages are not themselves consistent, but educated people tend to buy into whole packages, whereas less well-educated people tend to have much more of a kind of mix. They're a bit left-wing on this, they're a bit right-wing on that. So I often say my political credo. I mean, I used to be very much on the left. I would now regard myself as kind of I'd call myself centrist, for want of a better word. And my political credo comes from the great American sociologist Daniel Bell, who said that he was asked sometime, I think back in the 1980s, he was asked by a journalist for his credo, and he said, "I'm a social democrat in economics, I'm a liberal in politics, and I'm somewhat conservative in social and cultural matters." And this is what I think of as the sort of missing majority, the sort of lost majority in many of our countries, that for all sorts of sort of contingent historical reasons, I mean, the left in the 60s, starting in the 60s and 70s, went off in a very, very liberal direction. Most of the centre-left parties in Europe became essentially liberal graduate parties by the 1980s and the 1990s. Conservatives went off in a very free market direction, at least briefly in the 80s and 90s, at least particularly in the Anglo-Saxon world, less so in continental Europe. But that combination, that sort of Daniel Bell combination, has never found expression, really, although it does in a sort of mutant form in populism, oddly enough. But I think you're right that, you know, I mean, you know, to be fair, this is obviously not true of all anywheres, but there is a certain strand of kind of, you know, polemical anywhere ideology with it that is very it's very anti-democratic. It's, I mean, you had people saying things after the Brexit vote in Britain that really was tantamount to saying, why did we ever give these people the vote? You know, they wanted to kind of roll back history so that only, you know, only members of the kind of educated liberal class were allowed to vote. And there's just a kind of, you know, and anywheres tend to think that they are superior to somewheres, but actually they're often less pluralistic. They're often more illiberal than the supposedly illiberal somewheres. Now, there are illiberal somewheres. I mean, you know, like you talked about the global villagers are the extreme end of the anywheres. Well, there are genuine nativists and racists who you might say are the extreme end of the somewheres, but they're only a relatively small and declining minority in most of our countries. I mean, people on the left have to constantly talk up the threat from them, and I think in most cases, most of the time, they are a declining threat. But and I think that, you know, and people have moved with the time substantially. And also, just if you look at the actual lifestyles of many people that one might call somewheres, they have traditional attitudes and beliefs in many respects, but they often don't live at all traditionally. I mean, in fact, you get this flip anywhere. You know, if you look at something like marriage, you know, anywhere, liberal anywheres are far more likely to be married than somewheres.
They have a nice house. Safe home.
Yeah. I mean, and the average somewhere, you know, is quite likely to, you know, to not believe in God, to take drugs, to, you know, have all their partners had abortions. I mean, they often don't live at all traditionally, but they do see the value, perhaps partly because they've lost some of the values of traditional institutions like marriage. They can see the loss and experience the loss, and often have a nostalgia. I mean, as your book is partly about, I think.
Yeah. We'll go just one last question on this about the anywheres and the somewheres. Are the somewheres now happy about Brexit?
The somewheres were... it was mainly somewheres, not only, but mainly somewheres who voted for Brexit. I think it's too early to tell. I mean, I think, you know, there is a... obviously, Brexit is disruptive. Some of the disruption has been disguised by the pandemic. As the pandemic recedes, it'll be possible for the anywheres, you know, the remainers who are still kind of fighting the last war, to point more and more fingers at, you know, any decline in GDP that they can attribute to Brexit. They will, and there is still a minority, quite an influential minority, who have kind of not given up. I mean, I think most remainers, are sensible enough to say, okay, you know, we didn't want it, but it's happened. You know, let's make a go of it. But there is still quite an influential minority who who will try and turn any problem that Britain has into the result of Brexit. I mean, you know, on the other hand, we've seen certain developments that could, positive developments that could be attributed to Brexit too. I mean, the fact that we were out of the traps earlier than other countries on the vaccines. Now, I think technically we could probably have done that even if we'd still been in the EU, but it's kind of the mentality. It was the kind of Dominic Cummings, Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, yeah, Brexit mentality that allowed us to sort of get ahead of the game there. And I think there are other things. I mean, this is a long-term project. And the main reason, although...
So you don't know yet, basically, yeah, if you're happy.
Yeah, there are all sorts of, as it were, proximate reasons for it to do, yeah, say, with free movement and, yeah, people objecting to that. Yeah. But yeah, I think the bigger underlying reason is just... And perhaps this... I think there's an awful lot of nonsense talked about imperial nostalgia, that somehow Brexit was all about, you know, wanting to go back to being the sort of great British Empire. I think there's absolute nonsense. One of the remarkable things about post-war Britain was how we dissolved an empire without any reaction. Without any, there was no major political movement that was hostile to the end of empire at all. Everybody was quite happy to see the... Well, yeah. Virtually everybody was quite happy to... You know, and we're very unusual in that respect, actually. Yeah. You know, if you look at countries like the Netherlands, France in particular, I mean, the whole Front National party came out of the Algerian War. And we were very fortunate. I mean, it's not to do with our, you know, there's nothing mystical about this. It is just that we had the good fortune not to have big settler populations in our colonies. So people went out to India for kind of 10 years and then came back. We had, I mean, very, very small settler population. So actually, empire left less of a mark. But in one respect, I think the fact that we were used to being a rule setter to the world, rather than a rule taker. We were a rule maker. So that meant that we were, as it were, more attached to democratic accountability, because we were used to, you know, having been a sort of big country which set the rules. Now, many other countries, perhaps including Sweden, have been used to having to fit in with other big countries, you know, with Russia, with Germany, with Britain. And obviously, you've had a national democracy too, in which you've taken decisions. But you, particularly when it comes to things like foreign policy, you've had to take account of the rest of the world. And I think to the extent that there was a sort of a residue of empire in the Brexit vote, it was that we place more attachment to democratic accountability, and people could see that was being siphoned away by the European Union for perfectly, you know, I mean, to run the European Union properly, you do have to have majority voting increasingly, and yeah, you know, as integration happens, and you know, you're going to,
we're doing it, yes,
yeah, you're going to, one year, one you're year going to lose your own national voice over more and more aspects of Swedish daily life, particularly in the economic sphere, but in, you know, tax levels, all sorts of, you know, VAT levels, whatever, you are not going to be able to control. And I think British people, you know, that is the primary reason, the primary rational reasons, there are all sorts of emotional reasons too, but the primary rational reason for Brexit was that we placed a higher value on democratic accountability than the European Union was going to allow us to practice. Mm.
I want us to shift now, go over to the book that you published in 2 years later, I think, in 2019, was called Head, Hand, Heart. And I gather that book was a natural offspring somehow from The Road to Somewhere, your book about the somewheres and the anywheres, because it really deals with the rise and the rules of the anywheres. And you are saying that we have reached peak head. What do you mean by that?
Well, just to pull the camera back a moment, I mean, so head, hand, heart, the meaning is sort of in the title. I mean, I'm arguing that the sort of anywhere cognitive class, or rather, you know, one form of human ability, one human aptitude, the kind of analytical, cognitive, exam passing, you know, information processing skills, has become far too much the gold standard of human esteem, and it has attracted to it, particularly in the last, you know, it's a cliche of labour market economics, you know, the return to education in the labour market has been one of the most striking features of the last 50 years, and you've seen a corresponding decline in status and reward for manual technical occupations and indeed caring occupations too. One of the really striking things too is that what's happened, we touched on this earlier, but with the mass higher education has produced like a single ladder up into this sort of cognitive class, whereas there used to be lots of little ladders up. There used to be lots of different elites spread around Britain or Sweden. You know, there was a trade union elite. You know, there were lots of regional elites. But now everything has been sort of forced into this academic cognitive class route. That has exacerbated what we were talking about, many of the kind of anywhere-somewhere divides. And it's another example of the kind of lack of emotional intelligence of our leaders. I mean, Tony Blair announced that he wanted 50% of school leavers to go to university back in 1999, and we've just achieved that a couple of years ago. No one seemed to give any thought. It's what I call the 15-50 problem. When I went to university, only 7 or 8% of people went to university. We clearly needed to expand higher education. We undersupplied it back in the 1980s. We now oversupply it, I think. But when 10 or 15% of people in your school or town go to university and you don't, well, it doesn't matter. You go and work in the local office or factory or whatever, life goes on. If 50% go and you don't, well, then it's completely different psychological ballgame. You feel like a second-class citizen. And no one seemed to give any thought to that, what the effect would be. And obviously there's been a huge bias towards people who came from already educated homes. Yes. It hasn't done, you know, people claim this has been marvellous for social mobility, as if social mobility never happened before. Back in the 1980s, even in the early 90s, I think most people in the professional and managerial class didn't have degrees. But, you know, they many of them still rose from quite humble backgrounds into that class. Peak Head is actually kind of optimistic. It's saying this has got to come to an end. This is already coming to an end because it turns out the knowledge economy doesn't need that many knowledge workers. So if you look at the top two social classes in the UK, I mean, there are lots of different ways of measuring class, but one of the ways is I think it's a 7-class schema. You have the professional and managerial higher and lower. They're at the top two. And a very large number of people are in those top two classes, more than a third of the population. It was actually 35% of employees were in those top two social classes back in the year 2000. Last year, the number had increased from 35% to 37%. I mean, so that's still a small increase, but there was a huge increase. If you go back to the kind of 1970s, 1980s, there was every year on year, there were huge, it's so-called more room at the top. More and more of these very desirable professional jobs were being created, partly through the expanse of the welfare state, actually, you know, needed more doctors and teachers and so on. That has, broadly speaking, come to an end. Now, you've had the knowledge economy too, but it turns out that AI... artificial intelligence is actually now aiming for the kind of middle and lower levels of the cognitive jobs. You know, the people in the law firms and the accountancy firms and even in medicine who've been doing relatively routine... It may be a graduate job, but it's a kind of relatively routine graduate job. That is going to be replaced by AI increasingly. So what we're going to see, indeed what we're already seeing... is a very large group. Well, two disappointed groups now. We've got the 50% who don't go to university at all, who often feel themselves to be second-class citizens because of the whole prestige attached to the cognitive and the professional. But you've then got an increasingly large group of people who have been to university but have disappointed expectations because they're not getting the high-status professional jobs. More than a third of British graduates are not in graduate jobs 10 years after graduating. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the figures were going to be relatively similar here in the coming years anyway. You've got this... It's sometimes called elite overproduction. There's a guy called Peter Turchill, I think it is, who's written about this. And it can be a very destabilizing political force. You've got quite a big part of the educated elite who are very dissatisfied because they're not in, you know, they're working in pretty poorly paid back office jobs. And they, you know, you could put things like the Bernie Sanders movement in America, perhaps Jeremy Corbyn in Britain, the BLM movement even. If you're a black kid leaving university and you don't get a decent job, you might understandably think, well, it's it's because of my race. Whereas actually it might be, I mean, it's possible that it is because of your race, but it might equally, it's more likely to be because of this structural imbalance that I'm talking about. And meanwhile, of course, as you were saying, employers are absolutely crying out for, you know, we've got all this expensive kit that keeps a modern society going that needs to be maintained, you know, from power stations to our laptops. And we don't have the technical people to do it any longer. And we have a crisis of recruitment in the care sector as well.
Yes, yes.
Partly as a result of the, you know, the benign development of modern feminism, which has freed women from domesticity and care roles, both in the home and in the in the public economy.
So we're having a lot of trouble here. We have the unsatisfied somewheres that we talked about before, and we also have the dissatisfied anywheres who don't get anywhere because they're not the jobs for them are not there. And I know that care is the field into which you are now moving for your next book. So I wanted to ask you one thing that you are saying in the head hand heart book is that perhaps, you know, eventually relative wages will fix the situation, so people will be allocated to the right sectors. But then you have first the question, who's going to pay for this? If it's care, is it then the taxpayer who is going to pay, or is it the private citizen who's going to pay more, which will in that case sort of change societies, certainly social democratic societies, in a big way? But also, do people want to do care job? Even if it was better paid, we have a crisis of teachers in this country. Even if they are much better paid now than before, they don't want to do the job.
Mm. Well, I think it is. I mean, I'm relatively optimistic about this in that I think some of this is self-correcting and has been. You know, we have seen a big increase in wages at the bottom. I mean, it's now getting slightly confused because of the rise in inflation in most of our countries. But I expect that to continue. We're seeing a little bit of a pullback from globalization, a little bit of reshoring. I think we'll see, partly a result of the kind of PPE panic during the pandemic, or the fact the pandemic, you know, made us feel rather kind of exposed in some ways. You know, these you know, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your supply chains. You know, that we were suddenly became very conscious of the fact that so much that we depended on was coming as the sort of end point of these long and quite, and in certain circumstances, quite vulnerable supply chains. So I think there will be more of a bias towards local production. We haven't seen much evidence of that so far, but I think it's quite likely to come. And I think it's going to be, I mean, one of the other good things about the pandemic has been the fact that we've discovered it so easy, particularly people in professional and managerial jobs, to work from home, which I think will make it easier for women to combine career and family more. I mean, that's not such an issue here because of your more or less free childcare, you know, from the age of 1.5 or 2. But it's certainly an issue in Britain and a lot of other European countries. But the more fundamental question, I think, is a good one. You know, is it that we have placed so much status on the public realm, on particularly the sort of professional managerial occupations within the public realm over recent decades, that it's not surprising that people and more women, you know, want to abandon, as it were, you know, traditional female roles, and women are status-seeking animals just like men. and they follow where the status is. And if the status is all in, you know, being an investment banker, working in the broadcasting industry, you know, all of those sort of glamorous high-status jobs, then that is what people will want to do. But I do think the pandemic perhaps helped in that respect too, actually. It kind of made us think about what we really value. Family life was placed under stress, and there was an increase in domestic abuse, I think, in most countries. But also, I think there was, you know, in the majority of cases, I think there was a recognition of the actual central importance of the domestic realm to most people. And I think, but you know, part of the issue here is how to, as I said earlier, I mean, how to raise the status of care, both in the home and in the public economy in an era of gender equality. So it has been one of the great achievements of recent civilization that women are no longer, that they can free themselves from traditional domesticity, even if they have children.
The dilemma we have, certainly in Sweden and maybe in Britain too, I don't know, is that the biggest part of the women who are stay-at-home mums today are immigrant women. And that means that they do not get a job, they don't get out of their apartments often. And that also means that they don't learn the language. And if they keep the children at home and for a long time, for many years as they are young, the children won't perhaps learn Swedish so well either. So what should we do about this?
Because yeah, I agree, really, that is a real problem. In fact, I was just having lunch with Caroline Hoogland, who's a kind of maternalist feminist.
Yeah.
And we would discuss, and she was saying there are actually various projects in which, you know, take language lessons to the women in their homes or in their local community centres where they can go with their children and learn Swedish. I mean, I agree, this is it's absolutely vital. I mean, these women should not be forced to abandon their own traditions. I mean, you know, you have a very laissez-faire form of multiculturalism, but it seems to stop when it comes to domesticity. And actually, I think that is the one area where you really should allow even people from, you know, people from traditional societies should be allowed to look after their children at home until they go to school. There are many Swedish women, ethnically Swedish women, who would also like to do that. But I think you get around it, and it's, you know, it's a real dilemma, I agree. But you get around it by taking language lessons to them. I mean, you know, that's not cheap, but, you know, for the good of your society in the long run, I think it's the only sensible way to do it.
One thing that I find puzzling is that some of the minorities that we have in Sweden, we have quite large minorities of Iraqis, Somalis and Eritreans, do much better in the UK and in Canada and also in the US. In particular, that is the case with the Somalis. Why could that be?
I think this is true in many countries. And we have, so Caribbeans in Britain don't do particularly well compared to Indians and Chinese, who do far better than the white British. We actually have there's a higher proportion of visible minority people in the highest social class in Britain than there are white British people. So lots of people are doing very well who came here from the Commonwealth countries after the war. But some are doing less well. Pakistanis and Bangladeshis are doing less well. And Caribbeans are kind of in between. Caribbeans do very well in the United States. So it all depends on kind of history and context. I think Somalis are a mixed picture in Britain. Many of the Somalis we have, particularly in Leicester, where there's quite a large Somali community, actually came originally from the Netherlands. So they had actually been in a European context for a few decades, I think, before moving over, partly because of the economic opportunities were greater in the UK. We've got a more open economy. I mean, I think, you know, you get different outcomes for different ethnic groups in all countries, depending on the group. It's the internal sort of cultural dynamics of the group, the history of how it was that they came there, what, you know, levels of education, the social class. So Iranians do quite well in Sweden because they tended to be middle class educated people who came because they didn't want to live in a theocracy in 1979. You know, Iraqi Kurds similarly, I think, do relatively well in Sweden, and I think that'll partly be for sort of class and sort of culture attitude reasons. You know, they put quite a high store by education. Other groups don't. So You know, I mean, I don't think you kind of need to beat yourself up about this because it happens everywhere. Mm. You know, some groups do better than others. And what one thing you should do, though, I mean, I think you foolishly follow the French model in not collecting statistics by ethnicity, which is really, really silly. You know, you want to, you know, particularly, you know, a country as liberal-minded as Sweden, you worry about why different groups are doing well. Well, you need to know as much as possible. So for God's sake, take a British view on ethnic minority statistics, not a French view.
David Goodhart, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
CSRD. Ännu en förkortning som väcker känslor hos företagare. Men lugn, våra rådgivare här på PwC har koll på det som din verksamhet berörs av. Från hållbarhetslösningar och nya regelverk till affärsutveckling och ansvarsfulla AI-strategier. Välkommen till PwC.
Kolla menyn.
Vadå?
Kan det stämma?
12 köttbullar med mos för 32 spänn. Mm. Otroligt!
Då får det bli efterrätt också.
Lätt!
Onsdagar är Happy Days på IKEA. Fram till 31 maj äter du som är eller blir IKEA Family-medlem alla varmrätter till halva priset. Vi ses i restaurangen på IKEA.
Välkommen till Momang, ett nytt smidigare kasino från Svenska Spel, Sport och Casino, där du enkelt kan spela hur lite du vill. Idag har vi Gonzo från spelet Gonzos Quest här som ska berätta hur smidigt det är.
Sí, es muy excelente y muy rápido.
Tack Gonzo. Momang, för dig över 18 år. Stödlinjen.se.